This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. Right now, there are a lot of jobs. This week, the Labor Department reported more than 7 million openings nationwide, with just over 6 million people unemployed. The rate of job openings is pretty high right now. It's the fifth month in a row that there have been more available jobs than jobless people. Now, high unemployment is obviously bad, but super low unemployment presents its own problem. How do you recruit people into jobs that need filling? What's it like being an employer right now? Are you able to hire the help you need? Maybe you're looking for work. Do you feel like you have a lot of choices? If the jobs market is so competitive, why aren't we seeing wages grow faster? We'd love to hear from you. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream, or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin with a view from here in New Hampshire. Joining us in studio at New Hampshire Public Radio is Dan Gilliou, a welder who's been living and working here in the Granite State for more than 20 years. He is the owner of Gilliou Construction Services. Dan, welcome to 1A.
Hey.
Also with us is Russ Tebow, the president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consultancy based here in New Hampshire. Russ, thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dan, let me start with you. You're a welder. You run your own business. Give us a sense of what you deal with on a regular basis, just trying to find enough people to get your workload done.
Well, it's hard. One of the biggest reasons it's hard is there's just no qualified welders out there anymore. A lot of them aged out, and the education system really hasn't put enough time into vocational trades anymore.
Give me a sense of what you got to do. Say you've got a job and you don't have quite enough people. What kind of hoops do you have to jump through to try to find people? Are you like making phone calls all day, or knocking on doors, or like what's your day look like?
Usually the first thing I do is I go to my existing employees and say, do you have anybody that you know of that may be looking for work? And sometimes that works out, and sometimes it doesn't. So then, you know, you have to, you know, put the word out there that you're hiring, and you're hiring basically an apprentice, and you're going to be teaching on the job. Really slows down the progress that you can make, and you know, it's a challenge for any employer, no matter what trade they're in, to be starting ground up every time.
Was there a point, Dan, at which you began to kind of feel the impact of the labor market? Like, at what point did it start to noticeably be different for you in terms of just filling the positions you needed?
I'd say right around 2010 or so, when it started to get a lot harder. You could run ads in the local papers. You could put the word out by mouth. And, you know, it seemed like before 2010, you could get five or six people in a week inquiring on a job. And that, you know, after 2010 and up to now, you might get three in a month.
I've heard that one of the challenges with keeping people employed here, not just in welding, but in a lot of things, is in keeping wages competitive, that people who do various kinds of work, whether it's welders or substitute teachers or whatever, you know, the wage pressure makes it hard to fill jobs. How much do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, I think anybody in the business that has good employees, you know, really feels it. And, you know, you always want to keep the people you have because there's nobody to replace them. So higher wages, keep good employees. And I know that some of my competitors, they pay a lot less. I bring an apprentice in at, you know, $20 an hour, where my competitors may be at $12.50, you know, or $15 an hour. And I have, you know, I'm able to keep good people. And that's key to you know, keep moving forward.
With the people that you say you're able to keep good people, with the people that you lose, what's usually the last straw? I mean, are they leaving just for more money? Are they leaving because they're tired of the cold weather? Like, when someone decides to go, what's the thing that usually pushes them over the top?
Usually it's majority is just people aging out. They're getting too old. you know, a lot of my workforce are over 40. And, you know, when you start to get, you know, 40s and 50s, you're burned out. And, you know, there's really no 18, 19, and 20-year-olds coming into the business. Not like they used to.
Russ Tebow, how much does Dan's story sound familiar across New Hampshire in industries other than welding?
Oh, it's absolutely right, straight down the middle of the issues that we face in New Hampshire. There are labor shortages right across the board, despite the fact that we, you know, have a very good economy measured by a lot of the statistics, 2.7% unemployment rate, lower than the national rate. We've added 65,000 jobs in the state. But I think, you know, if you look at where is the pressure greatest, I think it's on the skilled trades, carpentry, welding, plumbing, electrical trades, and in the healthcare field as well. But the experience of Dan is very much in line with the overall New Hampshire economy. 30% of our workforce now is over age 55. So they're going to be retiring over the next 10 years. Here in New Hampshire, we have about the second highest median age. We're not attracting a lot of young people into the state. So what Dan has said fits exactly with the number work that I crunch all the time.
We're speaking to Russ Tebow, the president of Applied Economic Research, and Dan Gilliou, a welder who is also an educator at a makerspace called Maxed Makerspace, which we'll get to in just a moment. Glad to hear some of your stories about what you're seeing where you live with regards to the labor market in New Hampshire or elsewhere. We'd love to get some more of your questions and thoughts, and particularly if you're finding a way to deal with this, either as someone who is hunting for workers or hunting for a job. What kinds of obstacles are you running into, and how are you getting around them? Or for that matter, if you are thinking about a change, if you might be one of these people who's kind of ready to move on from your current profession, what do you see in terms of people to replace you, to succeed you? Is there anyone? If not, is there anything that you hope can be done about that? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Raymond posted on our Facebook page, "Let's keep sending kids to college for non-essential degrees and hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt so they can work as an office drone making barely enough to pay rent while skilled labor jobs just sit empty." Janice wrote, "We have had half a century of shaming for having a job not requiring college education. What did you expect to happen?" Dan, you've been working to try to get more welders in the pipeline. You created a training course, is that right?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, I've taken a lot of data from the last decade and a half of me training people on the job. And I put those numbers down, analyzed those numbers, and I came up with just an average amount of time that it takes to actually get somebody proficient. And get them to the point where they could be a certified welder, and then you just put them in a truck and have them go to the job. So that number is 130 hours of instruction. And when I say instruction, I'm talking about one-on-one instructor in front of you, showing you. You know, on the job site, 130 hours could really equal 3 years, mm-hmm. because you don't have... You can't spend the whole 130 hours, you know,
like
at
welding
one time.
And welding and welding, yeah.
Yeah,
so it's almost a kind of a compressed way to teach somebody how to do this.
Right, right. So I've you know, been thinking about this for years now, and you know, I've gone and I've seen the technical colleges and what they're doing for welding, and I've seen even the high schools that, you know, what they have for welding programs, and they're just not hitting the mark. They're not doing enough to, you know, allow people to enter the workforce without needing extensive training on the job.
Well, we're certainly hearing from some folks who agree with you about the need for this. Diane is in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Diane emailed, "Here in New Hampshire, we have a great mismatch between skills and jobs. We are an aging population and need skilled tradespeople to replace our plumbers, electricians, locksmiths, etc." I know we've only got you for another minute or so, Dan, but I wonder if there's someone out there listening to this who is considering a skilled trade. What do you like about being a welder? What makes welding a fulfilling profession?
Well, anybody that's artistic, that you know, likes to create, being a welder is probably the best thing you can do, because your canvas is big. It's huge. It's the skyline. You drive into Boston, I've worked on some of the biggest buildings in Boston. And when I drive in there and I see that skyline, I see the Millennium Building, and I see the Boston Convention Center, and I see the Zakim Bridge, I made that happen. I was part of that happening. That's my canvas.
I can't think of many people who can describe their jobs in as rewarding a sense as you just described yours. And yet more people aren't doing this work. Before we let you go, if someone wants to get started wherever they are with a skilled trade, is there something in particular they should start doing, or like a class they should start taking, or like what's step one?
Well, step one is, you know, if they're interested in welding, they can always get a hold of us at Maxt. And
that's M-A-X-T.
Yes. Yeah. And they can come in for Tuesday and Thursday nights. I do a 2-hour intro to welding if they want to learn TIG welding or MIG welding or whatever it may be, you know, any part of welding. We do a crash course, and usually it'll give people an idea if they really want to do it or not.
Dan Gilliou is a welder living and working here in New Hampshire for more than 20 years. He's the owner of Gilliou Construction Services. Dan, I hope you've recruited a new generation of welders. I never would have thought of your profession that way until you described it that way, but I'm glad that you said it, and I'm glad you made time for us. So thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me in.
So if employers can't find workers and unemployment is record low and the jobs numbers keep growing, are we officially in a labor shortage? We'll get to that in just a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you from Concord, New Hampshire. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing the job market and the difficulties in getting America's job openings filled with regional economist Russ Thiebaud of Applied Economic Research here in New Hampshire. We'd love to hear from you, too. Share what you know about finding a job in today's economy. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream courtesy of New Hampshire Public Radio. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A at WAMU.org. Before we keep going and introduce our next guests, I just want to kind of add a yes and amen to what Dan Gilliou just said. There is no shame in getting a career that doesn't require a college degree. None. And we did a show last year called How to Earn Six Figures Without a Four-Year Degree, about how to get into some of these skilled trades that require some training or an apprenticeship, but that don't require a four-year bachelor's degree. One of our guests, Nicholas Wyman, who is the CEO of the Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation, wrote a book called Job U, and he put a question and answer on our website about what an apprenticeship is. How does an apprenticeship work? When should you consider taking one? Where do you go to find one? You'll find all this information on our site, a program called How to Earn Six Figures Without a Four-Year Degree, online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Before we bring in our next two guests, Russ, one more thing about the job market here. You mentioned that New Hampshire has an aging population. Affordable housing is a challenge. New Hampshire is one of many states that's been hit hard by the opioid epidemic. How does all of this show up in the job market? Is it just an aging job market, or does it manifest in other ways than that?
Well, I think the main thing that we see right now is sort of the lagging wage growth in the state that is kind of a deterrent to bringing more people into the labor force, attracting more people to the state. Our wage growth has been around 2-2.5% a year. It's sort of lagging this prosperous economy that we hear so much about. I think one of the quips that I recall, a woman said, yeah, we have a great job market in New Hampshire. I should know I have three jobs, and I need three jobs just to get by. So I think that's sort of the main stumbling block right now. We're beginning to see a little bit of labor force growth. As I said, we've added 65,000 jobs in this state since the downturn kind of reversed course and started becoming an improvement, but we've only added 17,000 workers. So therein lies the crunch.
Glad to get to some more of your comments about what you're experiencing where you live with work, especially in skilled trades. Sean emailed, I work in a steel mill and union and management have been complaining about the lack of quality candidates. We're even taking McDonald's employees if they will come in. A big issue is drug testing. Half our potential candidates don't come in for an interview after hearing that we randomly drug test. Julian tweeted, "A gazillion jobs are of no consequence if they don't pay a living wage. All the jobs I see would shirk my education and pay a third of what is manageable." Let's try to zoom out a little bit more and talk about what's happening not only here in New Hampshire, but also nationwide. Joining us from our home base in Washington is Ryan Nunn, policy director of the Hamilton Project and a fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Ryan, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me on.
Also here with us is Christine Carr, the executive director for the New Hampshire Career and Technical Educators Association. Christine, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Ryan, can you give us the big national snapshot of what's happening across the country right now in terms of the labor market? We know what the national picture is. We've talked about New Hampshire. Are most states doing okay, really struggling? What does it look like on a more granular level?
Sure. Well, I think that it's important to start from a long-term perspective to understand where we are now. And I think it can be summarized with the idea that the labor market is not always linking workers with economic opportunity. I'd start by saying that productivity growth overall has been unusually low since the mid-2000s. Wage growth has also been quite weak. And then there's also tremendous variation in wage levels across the country. It's not always easy for workers to access jobs in those high-wage places. At the Hamilton Project, we've released a paper recently that describes how over the last 40 years, geographic mobility has plummeted, and those geographic imbalances, those wage differences I just mentioned, have tended to persist over time, and the struggling areas in this country are not generally catching up with the prosperous places.
We asked members of our 1A text club for their input. One person wrote us, "At age 71, I was shocked to be hired. I am a retired attorney working as a state employee." Ryan, do we officially qualify now as being in a labor shortage, capital L, capital S, labor shortage?
So I actually have a different perspective on this. And there's an example I like that kind of illustrates my thinking about labor shortages. If you go into a store and you offer to pay less than the posted price for something, and the store refuses to do that, we don't say there's a shortage. And I think the same logic applies to the labor market, that in recent years, we just aren't seeing broad signs of extreme labor scarcity in the national data. That scarcity should produce rapidly rising wages as employers compete for workers, and we just haven't observed that. You know, overall, real wage growth after we adjust for inflation remains very weak, and there's little evidence of earnings in broad industry groups outpacing other industries by big margins. For example, wage growth in construction and manufacturing is not so different than for the overall economy. And I'd also say that wages are growing at roughly similar rates across regions. They're growing a bit faster in New England and the Pacific states, but not tremendous gaps. And then I'll just end by saying that that's all to say that we're not seeing this at the broad national level, but there could certainly be particular occupations in particular places that are characterized by labor scarcity and that have seen some pretty rapid wage growth. I just don't think that's broadly true of the U.S. labor market.
We heard from quite a lot of you about just the nature of wages as an impediment to filling these jobs. Ronald posted on our Facebook page, "As someone who worked many years in construction, mostly trim carpentry, I can say wages in the field aren't enough to attract and keep people willing to do the work." Michelle emailed, "It's wages, not supply." And Christine Carr, I wonder if you might respond to this tweet from Fran, who wrote, "New Hampshire eliminated the state minimum wage a few years ago, so even though all surrounding states have raised theirs, we're at the national minimum wage. Thousands travel to Massachusetts daily, where the pay is much better." Christine, in terms of what you're dealing with, trying to get jobs matched up with workers, how much does the state's minimum wage factor in just structurally?
Well, I don't have any empirical data on why so many employees are working in mass and traveling there, but I know when I lived there that they reported over 500,000 commuters every day into the city and out, and many of those are coming from New Hampshire. So, you know, wages is one aspect of it, but there for sure is an actual shortage of people. And my feeling is we've got to really just focus on how we can get the people that we have into the jobs that are out there.
What do you see as the roots of that shortage, Christine? Was there a point at which you began to notice more viscerally that the job market and the labor pool were significantly mismatched?
You know, I feel like, you know, my point of view is got sort of a wider industry perspective in the sense that I've worked in technology for the last 10 years, and coming to New Hampshire and looking at each of these high-demand occupations, such as automotive, construction, manufacturing, there just seem to be shortages across every single sector, whether it's in manufacturing or in high-tech.
Let's get to a few more of your comments, particularly about the nature of what we've described as an aging workforce. Kristen in Wisconsin emailed, "To all the companies out there whining that they can't hire enough people, stop discriminating against older workers," and older is in quotes. "We are not old, and we have so much experience. Plus, we don't always want a huge salary." Jan in Manchester, New Hampshire emailed, "I know several educated and qualified older women who lost their jobs here in Manchester. They've been out of work for at least 6 months. I have overheard conversations at my local supermarket from older employees losing hours to 16-year-olds. Ageism is a big problem." Russ Tebow, how do you see this? The impact of older workers, especially in high-tech careers, especially in like Silicon Valley, it's becoming worrisome at this point, where if you're old, we've just decided we don't want you.
Yeah, I think that here in New Hampshire, it's kind of like, to a degree, that's less of a problem than it may be in Silicon Valley, for example, because if you don't hire and retain older workers, the chances are you're not going to get any workers, because our state's, as I said, our median age is the second highest in the country. So here in New Hampshire, I don't know that ageism per se is as big a factor as it might be in a more dynamic state. At one point, New Hampshire was adding close to 200,000 people a decade. Now we're barely staying even. So I think that the labor situation in New Hampshire is pronounced enough that ageism is not as big a factor. We desperately need these experienced older people to stay in the labor force.
Ryan Nunn, how do you see it? How much does age or ageism factor into the workforce mismatch?
Well, I do think that certainly discrimination of various kinds is a part of the set of impediments that, you know, may be keeping workers from getting jobs and from seeing their wages increase. I would point to a wider variety of impediments. I think that, you know, there are folks who have low levels of skills that are coming to the labor market and not doing as well. There are folks who have childcare and elder care responsibilities that interfere with their ability to work in particular jobs. And I think there are a number of other factors like these.
I wonder if we could also get to a comment for you, Christine, in terms of the kind of training that you provide with the New Hampshire Career and Technical Educators Association. We've heard from some folks who do skilled trades and how you feel about them. Matt emailed, "I'm a lineman in Central Illinois with a 4-year degree. I couldn't be happier with my trade, and a degree wouldn't have made me half the living that line work does. As a proud union lineman, I encourage young adults to seriously consider working somewhere outside a cubicle. It builds character and strength." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Christine, that was a ringing endorsement from Matt. Give me a sense of what kind of training you provide, particularly for young people who are getting into the skilled trades, who may not be used to hearing many of their friends talk about getting into the skilled trades. What's the training like?
Right. Well, the training is very much hands-on, just as Dan was describing when he was speaking about welding. If you look at New Hampshire and really any state in the country, there's a massive network of career and technical educators all across the country, and they're all faced with the same problem, which is we've got to get our graduates trained and skilled to fill the jobs that are out there in these high-demand sectors. So when you look at New Hampshire, sort of drill down to our state, we have 27 centers from north to south, east to west, staffed by incredible professionals. We have, you know, 27 very passionate and committed and professional directors running those centers to get kids trained in manufacturing, automotive, and construction industries, along with others like healthcare, financial services, and tech. And those programs take students from 10th grade through 12th. So by the time they're in 10th grade, they're already thinking about their career. They're looking at what kind of pathways they want to explore. And our programs guide those students through that process. And at the end of the experience, working within a CTE environment, those students have skills when they graduate. And they're ready to work, and they're looking for jobs.
Christine, I'm sorry, CTE environment, is that career and technical education?
It is, career and technical education, which is really an acronym for the National Community of People Who Are Involved with Training, Career, and Technical Education Programs, which is a massive community. I mean, in New Hampshire alone, we have 400 instructors or teachers who are delivering those services to our kids every day.
Russ?
I was going to say, I think that part of the issue here is that the technology of a lot involved in a lot of jobs has outstripped the ability of our educational system to keep up with it. I recall going through a manufacturing plant that manufactured ball bearings, and I looked into a room, and there were maybe 30 people sitting at computer screens, and I said, I didn't realize you needed that large an accounting department. And they said, no. Those people are running the machines.
They're not accountants.
They're not accountants. And so I think that the perception of a lot of blue-collar jobs is it's grunt work. And in fact, it's not grunt work anymore. It's really very technical and sophisticated work. And we need technical and sophisticated people to fill those jobs. And I think to some degree, there's a mismatch between the perception, the training, and the needs.
We got a voicemail from a student here in New Hampshire who is studying to become an automotive technician. Here is what he left in our inbox.
My name is Maxwell. I live in Deerfield, New Hampshire, and I currently attend Concord High School. I'm a senior, as well as I'm also enrolled in classes at Manchester Community College. My senior year is definitely a lot different than what most seniors go through. I'm not taking just regular general classes that aren't really going to help me. That's the whole point of me being in MCC, is so that way I can take classes that are needed in order for me to get close to my degree when I finally graduate. I plan on staying in New Hampshire. I originally was going to be leaving, but opportunities I have gotten have definitely pushed me towards staying in New Hampshire.
Maxwell, thanks for sharing your story with us, and best of luck to you for staying here in New Hampshire and going into your chosen field. Christine, I'm sure that you're heartened to hear messages like that from Maxwell, but what does it take to replicate that? How do we make more Maxwells?
It takes a lot of work. It really starts with middle school would be a good time to reach students, to start talking with them about the things that they're interested in, what they're inclined to do, and meet them, you know, where they're at developmentally. And that's happening in a lot of schools across the state and across the country. And in New Hampshire, we have a number of programs that are looking at how to create a career exploration pathway for students so that by the time they get to ninth grade, they have a much better idea of what the options are in terms of what kinds of pathways there are. Number one, increasing the awareness of what the options are, but then also having a better sense of what they're drawn to and what they want to do. And we're working on a number of initiatives within our community to institute or create a framework for pulling students through that kind of a learning experience, a career exploration learning experience.
I know we're going to lose you in just a moment, Christine, but I wonder what your sense is in terms of New Hampshire being a place that younger people want to be. I mean, it seems like a lot of millennials are eager to move to bigger cities, to places with a little more urban density. New Hampshire is gorgeous, but it is very rural, and it's not nearly as bustling a metropolis as, say, Boston. How much do you think the challenge here is just, and I hate to be blithe about this, but New Hampshire being New Hampshire, New Hampshire not being a place where young people are clamoring to be? Before we let you go, how much is that just a built-in challenge?
Well, I would argue that it's not really a challenge because really for young people, everything is here. They have a beautiful lifestyle. This state is designed for young people. You can do anything you want outdoors, you know, whether it's skiing or being up in the lakes. And there are a ton of young people really, really into that lifestyle. And as far as having cities and, communities to be drawn to, you look at places like Portsmouth, Concord, Manchester, Nashua, even in the western part of the state, there's some great small cities that have great options for young people, whether it's, you know, some kind of social life or
right.
other activities that they need to, you know, to have around them so they can feel connected. That's all there. I think the challenge is in the rural sections of the state and finding that connectivity when you're a little bit further removed. You have to find your people.
Christine Carr is the executive director of the New Hampshire Career and Technical Educators Association. Christine, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
So if you moved from your small hometown to the big city for new opportunities, what would it take to make you move back home? What if they paid you to move back home? That's ahead. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Russ Tebow and Ryan Nunn. Let me get to a few more of your comments before we bring in our next guest, particularly with regards to training skilled workers. Chris writes, as a current plant manager of a manufacturing facility and former manufacturing HR director slash production manager for over 15 years in both metal and plastics, I am calling BS. Manufacturing in the U.S. has completely abdicated any responsibility for training new employees since the 80s. They want experienced people at relatively low wages right off the street. If you want lower wages to remain competitive, you must develop an in-house training program that brings lower wage entry-level employees up to speed over time. We also heard from some of you in some pockets where employers are increasing wages. Here's one listener who left a voicemail in our inbox.
This is Bill. I live in North Carolina, and I work in the logistics and warehouse and supply chain industry. And we've had a pretty good expansion of our business over the last 6 months. And we're really struggling with two items. One is employee turnover, where they're chasing higher wages and new facilities and new employers. And secondly, trying to hire the right people. As a result of that, we've had to probably increase our incoming salaries, the hourly salaries, probably anywhere between 10 and 15 or 20% from what we did last year. So we're struggling with both turnover and securing the right employees. So having unemployment down as low as 2 to 2.5% is definitely impacting logistics and warehousing.
It's easy to see how. Bill, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Another one of our listeners tweeted, I hold a 4-year degree, strangely enough, in journalism, but transitioned into a trade job shortly following college because the pay was 3 times what a starting job in my field would be. I now make 6 figures yearly and work in the rural community I grew up in. I will withhold my thoughts on you abandoning your journalism degree. Good for you. Glad you found something that works for you. But this listener has an interesting point because to stem their brain drain, some cities and counties and states are offering to pay workers to move there. There's a city in Nebraska that'll match signing bonuses for newcomers to the tune of $5,000. Vermont passed a law to pay people $10,000 to move to Vermont and work remotely. And a county northeast of Detroit is offering to take a chunk out of your student debt. That plan was the idea of Randy Myers, the president and CEO of the Community Foundation of St. Clair County, and he joins us now to discuss it. Randy, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Joshua.
So this is called the Come Home Award. Tell us what the Come Home Award is. How does that work?
Yeah, the Come Home Award program that we launched and invented in early 2016 is really turning traditional scholarship business models on their head. There are too many flaws in traditional scholarships to talk about and go in depth, but at its core, what we're doing is changing the scholarship business model, and instead of investing heavily in a 17 or 18-year-old who may or may not complete college or maybe not be right for college, we flipped it around and we said we will pay you significantly upon completion of some kind of degree, but only if you return to our region to live and work. And it's really a come-home reward, paying off debt.
So this is for people who are from St. Clair County to come back home to St. Clair County?
Yeah, we have a very strong preference for those with family ties. I mean, to help protect our investments, we want people to know what it's like to live in small-town America. We want to keep them here. And so we feel that if they have some family connection here, it's probably a better bet they'll stay.
Tell me about St. Clair County. Paint me a picture. What's it like?
So it's small town America. It's a waterfront community along the shores of Lake Huron and the St. Clair River. Our largest town of Port Huron has a population of about 30,000 people. We do not have a 4-year university in our region. We do not have a Fortune 500 company in our region. 30% of our workforce leaves our county and heads down to Metro Detroit to be employed. But they love the small town life, the family-friendly environment and amenities. We're small town America, Josh.
I was just going to ask you about Detroit. You're about an hour outside Detroit, is that right?
Yeah, and you were talking about something earlier, Josh, I want to mention. You know, Detroit has become a talent magnet, mm-hmm. which is great for Detroit. But the health of America and the health of Michigan, I think, is better judged on the economic health of regions like Port Huron or Marquette or Muskegon, Michigan, right? It gives you a better barometer of what is our true health.
How did the recession do in St. Clair County? Were people hit there pretty hard?
Yeah, I would say it hit here earlier than it hit the country and much more severely. The ironic part that we tell people, and that's really one of the things that led to this come-home program, was once we really hit rock bottom, our stakeholders, whether it was philanthropy, government, business, any other sector, we realized that we all had to get together and play a piece in economic growth and prosperity. We all had something to bring to the table. But more importantly, we reached a point where we stopped waiting for someone from Washington or for someone from Lansing to come in and save us with a plan. It had to be an organic plan that drove our prosperity.
We're speaking to Randy Myers, the president and CEO of the Community Foundation of St. Clair County in St. Clair County, Michigan. Also still speaking to Russ Thibault, the president of Applied Economic Research, and Ryan Nunn, policy director of the Hamilton Project and a fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts about the labor shortage. 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream. So, Randy, tell me how the Come Home Award works. Suppose I'm from St. Clair County and I moved to Chicago for work, and now I'm considering coming back. How does that work?
Yeah, Chicago is a great example. Chicago, Austin, the South. As long as you do not have primary residence here, so let's say your parents still live in this region, maybe you completed college 6 years ago and you're still living in Chicago. But you've met someone, you've met a partner, you've met a significant other, you're weighing the option of staying in Chicago, which is a great place to live, or you want to come back home, settle down, start a family, spend more time doing what you want to do. As long as you don't already live back in our region, you're eligible for a $15,000 award. If you're selected, we give the recipients 120 days to establish permanent residency. They have to find a job if they don't already have one. Several already have jobs lined up. And then we stretch those payments out over 2 or 3 years as the carrot to keep you here. And it's really a simple back-end scholarship. We pay the loan holder directly, which in every case for us has been the federal government.
So you pay it out a little bit over time. So by the time the 2 years are up, St. Clair County, or this program, the Come Home Award, will have put in $15,000 towards one's debt. I'm guessing it's like, what would that be, $3,750 like every 6 months or so, and it adds up to $15,000 over time?
That's exactly it, Joshua. And the goal, you know, is to really give young people, and I say young, they could be in their 20s or 30s or 40s, the chance to go 2 or 3 years without making debt payments. Nationally, I know you see data that says the average college student has $30,000 in debt. I don't know where they're getting that data, Josh, because out of the 50-plus applications we've received, our average debt is $80,000. That's a crippling amount of debt that's preventing people from living the American dream.
I can relate to that. I'd finally paid off my private student loans. I had to settle them. Oh, God, it was the most awful form of financial slavery I can possibly imagine. And definitely, like, that's a whole other hour where I will regale you with my tearful story of dealing with Sally Mae. Before, I know Russ Thibault wants to jump in, but before he does, Randy, I just want to ask you about some of the perception issues that we discussed with regards to New Hampshire. There is evidence that young people are moving to bigger cities in large numbers. You have talked a lot about this feel of kind of small town America. New Hampshire, specifically Concord, for sure, definitely feels like small town America. Do you think there's this misperception about smaller communities that young people are getting? I haven't seen a television show that kind of glorified young people in a small town since Dawson's Creek. I mean, you don't see it much anymore. Do you think young people are just getting the wrong idea about living and working in smaller parts of the country, that we're all just kind of dazzled by the big city?
You know, that's a great point. When I speak around the country about this program and this effort of talent attraction, there is a complete misperception that young people don't want to move to small-town America. One of the biggest impacts of this programming is dispelling that myth. Now, I'm not saying 10,000 young people a year want to move to small-town America, or New Hampshire, or this part of Michigan, but we've already had far more applications for this program than we can possibly fund. Our region needs to realize there is a growing interest in coming to small-town America. They just happen to be out of our line of sight, right, for people of my age. So it's really dispelling that myth. New Hampshire has a lot to offer, and there are young people that will move back home. We have to be open, though. How do we make that transition happen?
Russ, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I was going to say that
traditionally in New Hampshire, we lose 20-somethings. They move to a city, they go away to college, they eventually get married, and then when they turn to become 30-somethings, they move back. It's that latter thing that's missing this time around in New Hampshire. The 30-somethings are not moving back. The 20-somethings are still going away, maybe to New York, in my case, Washington, D.C. for a while. But when you hit 30-something, you move back, which is also my case. The other thing that I would note that's right up Randy's alley, in effect, is that I think there's a wholesale change in the concept of economic development that I'm seeing. I'm seeing it here in New Hampshire, which is that instead of trying to attract businesses to the state, we're trying to attract people to the state, and we're trying to improve the skills of people. So it's a more people-focused economic development strategy than we've traditionally had.
Ryan Nunn, what's your take on the Come Home Award?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. I did want to emphasize as I listened to this conversation that places like St. Clair County and parts of New Hampshire, I think, are facing a real economic challenge in that workers and firms often do value being close to dense labor markets and business ecosystems. Economists call this agglomeration economies. And there are often strong knowledge spillovers that happen within these dense markets. And so I think that there's a real challenge here. But I do like the idea of giving especially new college grads, you know, some space to do a more comprehensive job search and to look, you know, at places other than the New York City's and San Francisco's to kind of look more broadly.
We heard from Elizabeth, who lives in East Lansing, Michigan. Elizabeth emailed, "Most of my family lives in St. Clair and Marine City, and watching the county and small cities rebound gives me so much hope for the area and makes me so happy to see. I love this Come Home initiative." I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Randy, what's the long-term goal for the award? Is there a specific number of people you want to attract or a certain amount of debt that you want to cancel? What are your big metrics for success?
Yeah, that's an interesting long discussion, Joshua, because truly what we tell people, although the Come Home program has received national attention, we're very proud of it, that's really just phase one of rethinking talent. And something Russ said, I have to echo because that's what's driving us. Economic development is not attracting the next plant. Economic development is every voice in your region contributing to making a place where people want to live. For us, Josh, the long-term goal is for foundations across America to realize we have assets and resources to bring to bear on economic growth. We can develop talent. The Come Home program is a talent attraction program. We're putting far more money and time into growing the local talent that's already here. They'll provide a much greater benefit for our region. So for us, the Come Home is phase one. I think if we get to about 100,000 a year, Joshua, in that program, I think we're good. Our other program that is growing the local talent is about 300 to 500,000 a year, to give you an idea of scale.
Let me get to a few more of your comments in our remaining minutes together. With regards to hiring older workers, Scott emailed, "I work for a large telecommunications company that experienced explosive growth. I took a chance on an older gentleman that was in his 70s because he at least had a lot of experience. Not only was he able to immediately contribute, but 2 years later, he is a machine that works circles around everyone in the group. I strongly encourage hiring managers to consider hiring older workers." Steve emailed, "I have a dental lab in Indiana. We've always had trouble finding qualified workers. We invested in a training program when we opened our lab 18 years ago. It was a big investment, but it has paid off." And Lee emailed, "This is a multifaceted problem with many causes. I see one remedy: pay us more. Then we could afford our student loans, care for our children or elders, or being willing to move to where the job is." Ryan, what about Lee's comment? Is that really where the rubber hits the road, is just not being paid enough?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that we would expect these tight labor markets to result in some combination of higher wages, of firms looking at a larger pool of job applicants, and more employer investments in training, as has been discussed. And we're not seeing that to the extent that we expected.
Yeah, David tweeted, "I'm a blue-collar worker, and it's tough. The cost of living is outrageous. For example, my rent increased $40 just this year. I still make $15.50 an hour, and I've been at my current employer for 5 years. If you want a strong nation, you must pay a strong wage, period." Russ, I'd love you to respond to this voicemail from one of the listeners. Kate from New Hampshire left this note in our inbox.
I am one of those young people that is debating leaving New Hampshire for another job. And I actually feel really great about the labor market, and really great about the labor market in cities that might have a lot more art and culture and entertainment and things for people to do, and a generally younger crowd. So New Hampshire is an older state. And since I'm not from the state of New Hampshire, it's harder to keep someone like me here whenever they don't have the activities for people that are younger that might have moved to the state for a job. There's not a ton to keep you there once you've really mastered that job and are looking for the next step in your professional development.
Kate, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Before we go, Russ, what would you say to Kate?
I would say, Kate, take a close look. I mean, the state does have a lot to offer. We do have sort of the urban cultural things. We're close to Boston. You can get into Boston from here in Concord. There's commuter buses into Boston every day. So I think that there's an element of truth, particularly in the rural parts of the state. But if you look to the more urban parts of the state that are closer to Massachusetts, there is a wealth of cultural activities. Maybe not on the scale of Boston, but you're also not paying $4,000 a month in rent.
Very, very true.
There's a bit of a trade-off there, Kate.
Very true. Russ Thibault, the president of Applied Economic Research here in New Hampshire. Russ, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Josh, for having me.
Ryan Nunn, policy director of the Hamilton Project and a fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Randy Myers, the president and CEO of the Community Foundation of St. Clair County in Michigan. Randy, what an interesting program. I wish you all the best of luck. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, you can subscribe to the 1A podcast on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, on the NPR One app, or whatever app you like. And if you're new to podcasting, all the links to listen are at npr.org/1A. Today's program was produced by Stephanie Collette. To learn more about her and the rest of the staff, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.